Everyone, welcome to Beefano Podcast. And this week we're with Anonymous. What's good, my man?
Hello, Sifu. What's up, boss? Yo, everything's all good. Blessed.
So blessed, my bro. And yeah, man, this actually, we're back on track of counting the episodes. This is our 70th episode, and it's such an honor to have you on, my bro. And yeah, like, we're still going strong. But yeah, man, I guess to kick things off, how's everything going with you, my man?
Yeah, I'm in a really good place, man. It's been an interesting past couple of years, few years with COVID. Some real ups, some real downs and everything. But going back to what you were talking about, you're 70 episodes deep. That's consistency, man. That's just putting in that work. And I feel like I'm at the most consistent I've been in a long time, in terms of, you know, personal life and just, you know, getting on top of life outside of music. And obviously that makes me a better musician and creative when I step into the lab. So yeah, man, grateful for family, grateful for friends, grateful for the opportunity to share. Life's good, man. Life's good.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing. That's so awesome. Oh man, I just have so many places I can start because of, sort of when we started getting to know each other, but that can come later, I guess, for now. Let's go straight into it from, like, the sort of early days. How did music first come into your life? And, just earliest recollections and memories growing up as a kid with music, my bro.
Yo, I grew up in music in a traditional church. So I went to Mangere Samoan Methodist, which was a legendary church, because that's where the Sulemio brothers are from, and a lot of artists in the industry and choreographers and DJs and a lot of people in the creative scene now. We all came up through church together, Mangere Samoan Methodist. So that was like a real breeding ground. So we're always surrounded by music. But for me, it was I was kind of forced into music to play piano for church. The call went up from the minister, you know, to all the parents to put their kids into piano lessons so that we would have a supply of choir masters for the future. And I was one of those. And so it wasn't something that I particularly wanted to do. It was something I kind of was forced into to play, and, you know, went along to classical piano lessons. So I started with my auntie from about the age of 7, just learning through, you know, the grades and all that sort of thing, and got into classical and, you know, reluctantly went along, but gradually, you know, got into it. But in terms of as a fan, kind of like seeing music on TV, the earliest recollection I could remember was, I think, would have been like Michael Jackson. Yeah. Back in those days, and that was mind-blowing to kind of see his whole artistry and the way he made music and danced and everything. And then kind of later on from that, kind of first exposure to hip hop as a kid was, oh gosh, must have been N.W.A., Red Ed, Kingpin, some early stuff like that. But yeah, always been surrounded by music. And, you know, admittedly, I was an okay student playing piano. You know, I was a bit slack on the practice and everything. But it was later on when I discovered how MIDI suites worked at school, and realizing that I was one of the few people that could play and you know, make beats, and everything kind of really started to switch up from there. But yeah, from a young age, always been surrounded by music, mostly classical, Pacific, you know, Samoan, choral, traditional choir music, and early pop music and hip-hop. Yeah,
that's epic, bro. What a great melting pot, and what a great era growing up. That was like definitely the pinnacle eras of like technology, and Michael Jackson was definitely one of those guys who you know, like many others, was just like really already shifting like productions with, I mean, probably some of the best producers of like, you know, history of that time, you know. And I mean, to hear how this is all happening and being able to connect those dots with you being at school, and yeah, like all the different styles, but especially your own background, bro, which is so cool. And you know, like, man, I guess one thing that I love hearing from you, like, as I got to know you a bit better, was like the name Anonymous. And I actually remember listening to it on the podcast, and like, man, that name is so like it resonates with a lot of people who are in their similar sort of thing growing up, or you know, like of just having so many different people that it's almost like, who are you? Anonymous, you know. So man, that's so cool, bro. But yeah, I guess maybe share in your own words for those who don't know about you and the name, like how you got that name and how it came about, my bro.
Yeah, I mean, it carries on naturally from what I just mentioned. Like growing up, man, I was surrounded by not only music, different styles of music, but different like the different environments and demographics of that, of those music backgrounds, and they're all very conflicting. So like going back to, you know, learning classical piano lessons, like I would go the whole week without practicing, and then early on the Saturday morning I'd quickly, like, you know, get up early and spend 3-4 hours crash learning what I was supposed to learn from Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart, whatever. You know, I did the grades all the way up to 7, so I had to kind of be quite proficient at it. So I'd cram that lesson, and then my uncle would pick me up from Mangere and drive me to my classical piano lessons, which were in Mangere Bridge originally, and then Remuera, and he'd be blasting UB40 while I'm trying to hold these classical melodies in my head, and he's playing, like, you know, he's got a subwoofer playing all this reggae. And then I'd get there and I'd fake my way through the lesson, and then I'd go, you know, hang out that a whole Saturday night in the car park, listening, you know, subwoofers in the car, listening to Tupac, Dr. Dre, all of this type of thing, and would get hammered and you know, go all night. And then I'm the choir master for church, and so I'd get up on Sunday morning, you know, hungover, go to church, and now I'm playing, you know, accompanying the choir and playing classical music. Yes. And then go and chill and, you know, secretly text the girlfriend and listen to R&B. So the worlds of music and just they were just a big conflict for me, because obviously it wasn't the coolest thing to be in church and say, oh, I've got to go to classical piano lessons, and it's the classical piano lessons. I don't talk about my hip-hop world, but we're doing an A-way car park. And so eventually when I got into the industry and I had to come up with a name, you know, I was like, man, you know, I didn't know kind of exactly where I fit in. And eventually it just, you know, I used to go by the name Cypress, actually, back in the day. I love Cypress Hill. And so that was my adopted hip-hop name. But when I didn't want to go by that forever, and I was like, man, I don't, you know, as a hip-hop dude, you've got to have like a hip-hop name. And they were all taken and had some whack-ass names. But then I was like, you know, wondering out loud one day, and I wish I didn't have to have a name in this industry thing. And somebody, hey, there's a name for having no name. And I was like, what's that? And they were like, Anonymous. And I was like, yo, cool, that sounds like me. And then when I, you know, looked into it, and it's actually weird, it's one of these legal terms you can't lock down, spelt with an S. Like, it's like a John Doe. It's like an official non-identity. So I had to do the whole hip-hop thing and give it a Z. Anonymous spelled with the Z. But then the second inherent meaning became obvious as I kind of got in further into the industry, is because I'm quite diverse with a lot of the spaces that I work in. Like, you know, I'm working with hip-hop artists and classical, and then art gallery, bougie museums, and then fob choir music. And so kind of like it's the way I kind of make peace with myself, is like every time I go into a project, I'm a blank slate, and I'm like, who do I need to become for this project? Like, do I have to, you know, call upon my hip-hop, urban, growing up in South Auckland, Mangere background? Do I need to call upon my arrangement, orchestrations, that identity?
Yeah.
Do I need to call upon my fob, island, Samoan, traditional music? And so, yeah, that's the main story behind Anonymous. Is one, it was just, you know, fitting to have a name that meant having no name. And but secondly, it was more so to kind of reflect my process of being adaptable to whatever the creative project required.
Man, that's so cool. And like, I remember when I first heard that story, but it's just hearing it again, it really hits harder, because, man, my upbringing was so much the same. So I recall this one day, I was out at one of the churches in South Auckland. It was pretty close to Mangere. It was like one of the mega churches. And but I think it was like an arena or something as well. Life NZ or something. Yeah, one of the Life churches out there. And so we had our Get Smart conference when I was 16 or something. And then that holiday, I was like, man, I don't want to have to go all the way back to Palmerston North to go back to mum's, and then all the way back up to Auckland, back to dad's. And because that was the same holiday I usually go to see dad. So I thought, sweet, let's be clever and hit two birds before I go back. And the last day I can get dad to pick me up. And bro, it went from like, that was the last day where everyone gives their life to God sort of thing. it was the ultimate of like Christian music performance. And then dad picks me up. I'm telling him at the scout camp. He already knows it's a church, and I just absolutely get, you know, smacked in there with the whole, hey, you know, so that was my whole, you know, obviously my parents, you know, even though they had split up, you know, they had both found the best they could with their faiths, but it was so funny because I was like straight to the mosque, and then it was just like Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah. But it was with the actual legato and the tonality of singing, so it was like one extreme music to the other, and I always found that same thing, bro, like, just, man, you had to be really on your toes to be able to like be shift your hat and shift the way you approach, like, there was just a set way for everything. So it was like, you had to know how to be everyone at the same time, you know?
Totally.
So it resonates, bro. It just resonates so much, my bro. And it kind of gave me a lot of peace knowing that, yeah, it can be a lot more people than you realize, like, in their own stories. Not, you know, you think, oh, it's just my story, but these other people, and they've got their own story of going through those struggles of identity and
totally, man.
Yeah, man, it's like out of it can come some amazing creativity. Yeah, and that's probably the biggest message, like, straight away for people who are listening in who can relate and know that's probably where all like the best creative people in the earth have come from. Eh? That sort of that fight to find your place.
Now that you put it that way, that's so true. Because you know, to rewind time and be back in that youth body, I was like I would leave South Auckland with. So my parents would work really hard, and they got me in because I had a cousin who went to Auckland Grammar. So they traditional Pacific Island dream to put their kids into education and all this. So they got me into Auckland Grammar, which is a very Eurocentric school here. And I would leave South Auckland with my Auckland Grammar uniform, but I'd have a starter jacket over the top, my chains, my headphones, my Walkman, my feelers, and that, you know, I'd go all the way to school just as this hip-hop South Auckland character, and the second I get to the corner of school, like same spot under the tree, I would have to take off all my jewelry, take off my kicks, take off my cap, take off the starter jacket, and then adopt a different identity and be that, you know, Auckland Grammar scholar, Eurocentric, you know, blender type thing. And then after school was done, then get back and it was, you know, looking back at it, like I couldn't make sense of it then, but like you say, it's something that I wield as a strength now, you know, being able to pull upon these different experiences and different lenses of viewing the world and society. And so I'm just glad I made peace with it now, because I remember back then it was freaking confusing, man, and it was, yeah, I struggled with identity heavily as a youngster.
No one really sees it from your side, because everyone has their own identity, and you're like, oh, who are the people out here that have multiple identities and aren't forcing them upon others because they know that they're being forced upon them themselves? That's like the people that I was always turning to, and that kept me going for sure. And it was like cool to hear there'll probably be people as you grow up like that you could find that were similar. But was that quite a hard thing in terms of did it sort of take you to a certain point where you knew, oh, I want to do music, I want to self-express? Was there like a time you're into like maybe rapping it out or expressing I guess next steps with music as you're finishing up school?
Well, you know, to go back to the Michael Jackson influence and all of that stuff, like I was fascinated just with this concept of how music makes you feel through the different mediums that you're exposed to it through. So you know, I'd be looking at the TV, oh, there's Michael Jackson performing the song coming out of the TV screen, and then I'm playing the radio and there's no visuals, but it's the same song. But then when I wanted, I told my parents I really liked this Michael Jackson song or Red Hot Kingpin song, and they go, oh, we can go to the local music store, and then going there and seeing cassette tapes and then going, wow, is a song on that thing on the carousel, you know, and then, you know, turning the carousel with the M, Michael Jackson must be here, and finding his cassette tape and then going, wow, so the music's on this magnetic tape thing. And yeah. I put that. And so kind of, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of sound waves that are hitting your ears. But the way that it was coming at me as a kid, yeah, through the TV, through the radio, through the headphones, I was like, man, this music thing is crazy. Like, it's making me feel.
Yeah, yeah.
Yo. And so at school, you know, one day I walked into, I was fourth form. I remember the day clearly, walked into the music block in fourth form. I can't remember what that year is now. Is that year nine or something like that? Anyway, fourth form, walked in, and they were carrying this big computer upstairs with keyboards. And I was asking the teachers, like, what's happening there, sir? And they goes, oh, man, we've got a MIDI production suite. And I was like, what the hell is, what's a MIDI production suite? Because up to that point, I'd been making cassette tapes, you know. And, you know, that was the only way I knew how to make beats, which is, you know, swap tapes in the cassette tape deck from A to B, and you just keep layering that way. Remix. Yeah, but walking into school that day, and from what I gather, was, you know, Auckland Grammar was one of the first schools in the country to have a music production suite. And so when I walked into that room and I saw the keyboard connected to the computer, you know, at that point I could only play keyboard, like I was a pianist to play for church. And then, you know, it looked pretty self-explanatory. I was looking at the screen. I was like, okay, there's a playhead, there's a play, stop, rewind, and it looks like a record button. And then I remember hitting that record button, using the mouse to hit the record button. And then the line started moving from left to right. And I was like, oh, I guess I must play something here. And I just played, and, you know, I don't know what I play. I just played, jam something, and then intuitively press stopped and then rewind. And when I press play and it played back what I just played, my whole life switched. My whole life just turned around. And I was like, whatever just happened just now is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Like, this is, like, the ability to record things down and manipulate them and sample them and rearrange them, and, you know, reconstruct them into new compositions and records and remixes. And I was like, man, and that's where I caught the bug, man. And here I am, freaking decades later, still at it, still exploring, still having the tattoo.
Man, bro, I'm just trying to think, man. Like, back then, what would be the software they were on? Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was Logic. It was Logic 3.5. So
yeah,
fourth form. It was Logic 3.5. It's Logic 10 now. So I mean, that goes to show my age. But I got hooked on that program. And, you know, saved up everything I could to get my own Logic set up after school, which was, Logic wasn't owned by Apple at that point. It was run by a company, eMagic, I think they were called. And even that was trippy, because I got my whole first MIDI setup from a place called Guru Lounge in Green Lane. And that was one of the first sessions I went there to buy gear. It was P Money. He was doing a masterclass. And this is at the height of, like, the, you know, just the start of the Crusader stuff and some of his solo albums and stuff. And I was like, whoa, like, first off, this dude, P Money, is doing, like, all the same stuff as all these crazy hip hop dudes overseas, but he's a local dude and he's here, like, showing us the gear. And it was just the best time, man. I was so inspired. I caught the production bug then, and still at it, man.
Oh, that's so cool to hear that, like, all those little pieces of your first memories. And, like, it would have been pretty new to, like, New Zealand to have all this technology, to the point of people having computers to handle it. So it's so cool, and hearing our Logic and all of that, that's amazing, bro. But man, that kind of leads us into what happens next. So what was the moment where you felt like you had your first track on? Like, was it your own instrumental? Were you wanting to rap? What was the sort of direction you thought was, like, Yeah, and then what was the first stuff that came out, my bro?
So from that very first session, like, you know, I hadn't had that much experience making actual tracks back in school, but because I was playing for church, what I initially started to do, which was a, looking back at it, this is the first time I record this memory, but a lot of the church songs that we were teaching in choir, I would play those to a tempo, to a metronome, and then add subs to it, like so it'd be like traditional Samoan fob music, but like boot, like, because that in those days, man, like subwoofers and cars were the thing, man. I had a mate who had some earthquakes, and we would just boom around the hood in the weekends, and that was our thing, was just bass. Like, we would go on rides just to park up next to cars, just to see if we could set off the alarms. And so I started recording in these choral choir samples, and then just add 808s, just boom, and then, you know, dub them to a cassette tape, rush home after school, give it to my mate, play in the car, and we'd be tripping because he's like, whoa, this is that church song that. And so that's kind of where it started. I think, cut a long story short, what happened is after school, I didn't know it, but my piano teacher had given my CV to the Otara Music and Arts Center, and she had applied without me knowing for music, the piano tutor job there, which I got. But that became another domino into getting exposed to the OG Otara hip hop scene, and a lot of the icons that came from there, the Ermans, the Mr. Six, the Movements, the Young Sids, all these dudes, and kind of a new chapter unfolded for me there. But in terms of like first inkling of kind of getting that first taste of industry buzz was because I was at the Otara Music and Arts Center as a piano tutor initially. Alan X, who was the engineer back then, who's a legend out those ways, Alan Tongi, he was the engineer at Otara Music and Arts Center in their studio, which is a legendary studio. And he just pulled me in one day because he was working on the Ermine album, and he was like, you play keys, do you want a session on some of these? And my mind was blown, because I grew up on Ermine, and a lot of the Lost Tribes, the South Auckland OGs, and before you know it, I was in the sessions, you know, just, you know, session musicianing for them, laying bass lines, keys, pads, whatever I needed to do, and having the time of my life, because I idolized these dudes. And then one day he was like, yo, you got some heat, do you actually make beats yourself? And I was like, yep. And, you know, I was like, man, am I about to get my first placement on a project? And I was like, yeah. And it was like, you know, give me your best three beats. And I went home that night and, you know, dug up, you know, whatever my best beats were. And I settled on three of them. And one of them was like a real, cross between a Cypress Hill gritty, dusty loop and some Dre strings. And I was like, oh, I'm sure they'll be feeling this, and I gave it to them, and sure enough, the next day Alan was like, yo, not only do we want to use this on Ermine's album, so his second album Path of Blood, but we want it to be his lead single, which is a song called Bank Job, which is a real hood classic. Alan just kind of led me through the whole production, and they had a deal with Sony at the time. And so just kind of watching how these guys, you know, lay it down. And he was working on an MPC, which was new for me to watch, and an archive sampler, and just kind of watching them use analog technology and the desk there at OMAC. It was just crazy, you know, because I only had a little bedroom setup. So that was kind of like my first foray into like the industry buzz, and seeing how it goes through, and then going to Malcolm Black's house out in Titirangi and seeing the Sony heads do their thing and take it to the big studios for the mix down. So I caught the buzz, and I remember the morning at Hunter's Corner Sound. I can't remember the name of the music store, but I lined up on that Monday morning to get a copy off the shelf, just to see the CD and cover and see my name in it and all of that. So I was hooked from that, and that was my first industry placement, and just been blessed to have had many more since.
Oh man, so amazing. So OMAC is really the breeding grounds, and like, not just for you, for many people, but to see it still going today is incredible. Like, and to hear the stories of people who have come and learned. People I was talking with, even on the podcast, for people who will be listening, I was with talking with Shane Walker, and he said that how he remembers when you were doing theater, and then the thing, man, that's, but wait, before I was even getting into it, to think, man, there have been so many awesome things and people, and it all comes together to make New Zealand music the inspiration for the next generation, which I think is so cool. Like, to think, man, it's still just like strong as it has ever been, if not stronger, and I believe stronger. But man, what a cool testimony on a place like that, where you know, it was open to the community, and they were just like able to give you that opportunity. And that, to think, like, you know, you had those beats, but that was almost like the first beat you had actually kind of probably released, right? That actually ends up being not like a self-release little thing, but like, man, this is actually, they were able to say, no, we could hear something here, and bam, you know, like, that's a real cool way. Because apart from that, was it mainly just like music you would have kept to yourself, eh? It's probably not the thing you were, at the time, self-releasing was probably a lot harder than it is now, eh?
I mean, I had some groups that I was doing some beats for, and some up-and-comers, and you know, it was okay, it was doing well, but nothing major, nothing popping off. But really, that was kind of like the first project that kind of really pushed me to kind of see, like, you know, industry standards and thresholds of how things are done. You know, it's one thing, you know, me trying to do my little mix in my, you know, garage home studio at the time, and then to kind of see how when I took my production through, like, it sounded cool, but I didn't think, you know, in my limited experience then, Alan was like, yo, the snare needs to be fatter, this bass line needs to do this, and like those hi-hats need to straighten up. And so it was really I learned a lot from kind of seeing my production kind of be expanded and see it go through their lens and so forth, and then through their proper mixing. And I was like, wow, this mixing thing is a whole nother buzz. You know, I thought what you made was it. And so it was cool just to kind of you know, see how the different standards are kind of maintained at you know, when you're signed to a label. But also, I mean, it was just the most coolest thing. You know, one day my record would be walking in, like, I was just that little skinny scrawny kid at the back of the studio, like, just going, whoa, you know. I'm a blender, man. You know, Kaz would come in, my record, P Money, Lady Six, Lost Tribe, and I was like, man, this is, It was such an inspiring time for me. And, you know, to kind of hear, you know, the South Auckland artists that were on the radio, and they were walking into the studio, and I was able to play a bass line for them or do some stuff. So that was a really fundamental building time for me in terms of really setting my foundation in the game.
Oh, so awesome, man. And, yeah, man, I'm excited to check the place out. I see that they have things open all the time. And now that I'm based out here in Manukau, it's like, man, it's just meant to be, like, not just Omeg, but all the other cool spots. And but yeah, like, kind of I guess that kind of leads us more onto the recent times, and even when we first bumped in at the P Money workshop. So was there a sort of learning curve for you after you'd released that? Were there skill sets you were learning a lot about, coming with obviously a little bit of music knowledge on playing? Was there things like sound design? What were some of the earliest memories, maybe even with the software, like some of the tools you'd be getting your hands on since then, my first song?
I mean, you know, it was one fundamental thing that I think became quite apparent was, you know, because I first caught the bug, it was cassette tapes, and then after that phased out, it was like making beats and then putting them onto CDs. And then, you know, I got into Logic 3.5, and that was quite a big jump to Logic 5, and then to 6, and then to 7. And you kind of realize that the only constant in this game is change, is like the technology evolves. And so, yeah, the biggest change for me has been like the interface of Logic. And if anybody knows what 3.5 was like, it's completely different to what it's like now, but fundamentally it's still the same. But I guess one of the big switches for me in terms of my career was, like, I started off sampling a lot of, you know, Motown things, and like One thing I definitely wanted to model myself after, like, getting into the game was, like, P Money was sample king. Like, I grew up listening to his sample beats. And then you got artists like Chong Ni, who was, like, absolutely instrumentalist king. Like, he can make a beat completely from, you know, played from scratch.
Yeah.
And then eventually discovered Submariner, who to me was both. Like, he can sample as well as a P Money, and he can play instruments as well as a Chong Ni. And I was like, I wanted to kind of be in that lane. I wanted to be able to draw from both. So, you know, in terms of early on, I was playing a lot of my beats, like, because I was, you know, classically taught, I would be able to play, make beats from scratch and compose. And then really had to kind of learn my sample game, and then kind of, you know, chopping up samples and so forth. But what became quite experimental later on in the middle of my career, I guess maybe the last decade, is I kind of went off on a tangent, not just sampling the sounds of old music and records, but like getting really bougie and avant-garde and sampling the sounds of the environment and using found sound and making found sound compositions. But really at the heart of it was just, I guess, this hip-hop philosophy of just sampling. Like, sampling to me has been quite a big thing, because I guess an analogy I'd put is like you, when you go to a party, a good gathering that you're looking forward to, especially, I can only speak from going to the South Walker ones, there's always a vibe that builds up. You got your first people, and then the DJ starting to pump, and then the vibe builds, and then people can always detect there's this height of the party where the vibe is on, the music is on, and you just like, this moment, I wish this moment.
Yeah, that's true, right?
Because I know at some point it's about to go the other way, and somebody's going to horse it, or you get too drunk, and the energy goes down. Or everyone's going to go, and you lose the energy. And so sampling to me is that when you're digging through the crates and you're looking for, oh man, the music's making me feel this, and then you'll feel some part of the music and it jumps out, and you're like, I want this moment to last forever. And that's what sampling is able to do. You're able to take that 2-3 seconds, or, you know, whatever combination of snippets, and you take that feeling that you have in that small snippet, and you can loop it and have that feeling continuously forever. And so, like, philosophically for me, sampling is the act of keeping the party going at the height. Like, it's freeze framing the good times. Like, to be honest, like, maybe even the opposite too, because, like, you know, when we're down and out, we love hearing music that brings out the sadness and what we're feeling.
That's,
and
right,
it's not necessarily that we want the sadness to live forever, but we want to feel it in all its emotion,
right,
and so forth. Get, and that's what it's happening. So that would be like kind of like the main thing for me in terms of the discovery along the way, because I started off playing beats, but discovering sampling and kind of really exploring that as much as I could over my career, that's been quite a big signature in terms of the things that I've been up to.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I was just thinking, as you just mentioned sampling just then in conversations, like, instantly I thought about when I first did sampling vibes was from the disco tracks where you would hear people make house music out of it, like they call it French house, and like Daft Punk was just the beginning, and Justice, they were just the beginning, all the French guys, they call it the French touch, because it was like just instantly the sound, the, you know, even David Guetta, like someone who's real pop, he was starting out with that. And with the more I came across more French people like that, the more I was hooked on, like, that sampling is just, it can be so healing as well, because it's like, man, I want to just take this, and like, I don't have to worry about how it was in my hands, but it's in my hands now, and I'm gonna turn this into something that takes the best feeling and keeps it going with my touch on it, which I think that was like my earliest memories making some of my favorite disco house. And I was telling everyone, like, I was just making French. I literally was telling people when I'm in my hometown, I was like, I'm making French house, and they're like, what's French house? You don't know French house. It's like, man, like, it's the hottest thing. Daft Punk, that's French house right there. So sampling, it could be so healing. And man, it's been so long since I really was in the zone of sampling, because I think you've really got to take yourself back to that childlike mind too, right? Like, man, something is all about just like letting go, like just taking your coat off, just like sitting back and like, man, just getting immersive with the best, like you said, just keeping it going, eh? Like it never ends, the best moment. So man, yeah, it feels like I'm gonna get into more now myself, eh? Like you're just
fire and you and then there's also why you're speaking, it just reminded me of another element. Like, you know, when you listen in terms of the more traditional sampling of the classic 70s, 60s of vinyl and so forth, when you look at the liner notes, like quite often, you know, we dig and just look at the players or what instruments were used. And I think that's a beautiful thing because like a lot of these obscure records or maybe not obscure records, but you've got these players and instrumentalists who dedicated their lives to their art form, to the instruments. And they might have played on some obscure record and put their whole, you know, life, heart and soul into that performance. And it just ended up in some bin somewhere, you know, and that was the end of the playing. But the ability for us as producers to come and take that energy that they put in to this music and then continue it on, you know, it kind of makes them immortal. You're immortalizing these great instrumentalists and you're keeping the energy going. You're recycling, you're being efficient with the way the world, you know, recycles its frequencies and good intentions and keeping these people who had dreams, you know, keeping it alive. And so there's a lot about sampling that I really love.
Oh, hard out, man. I think for a lot of people listening in, it won't just be me, maybe there's someone else listening and we can take something from this podcast. Like I'm gonna try to do a bit more sampling, or I'm gonna get back to it, or I've never tried it, I'm gonna try. So man, that's so awesome. That would be definitely a gem for people listening in on the podcast days. Man, get have another try with sampling. And one thing I can't wait is I actually recorded some just a little Foley when I was overseas with them, and I was like, I can never afford a trip overseas, but then managed to hook us up, you know, being well behaved. So we managed to catch up with all of the dad's side of the family in Algeria, but we also got to stop in Paris and Paris and even Spain. There was a couple spots, and I like just recording just literally whatever is around, like if it's just a crowd of people. And that is like, I can listen back, and without those audio recordings, I will just struggle to get the pictures on my head. I'm going to listen back. It's all going to come. And then bam, you can just get onto a track, find a happy chord or whatever it is. And man, how magical, because like that, I think will be the healing part is if you've had great memories in life, you can use that as fuel to keep going when times get tough. And it's actually really cool because I felt that when we were listening to that track that you did with the movement and the actual sampling part was so magical because of this, like the stereo and all that. I was just like, whoo, this is quite a juicy addition, you know. It's kind of like just creeping out and back in, and that's what samples do, where they just kind of creep up on you. I'm like, ooh, what's that? You know, so man, wow, that's speaking on that, the travels, like then before I forget, like traveling, bro, like how has it been for you? Like, have you been able to go to any cool places overseas?
Oh, totally. Oh, music's been such a blessing. I mean, on the act of sampling, like every 4 years, in terms of the Pacific region, they have what's called FESPAC, the Festival of Pacific Arts, which is the Olympics for Pacific art. And every year in the Pacific, I didn't even know there were 29 nations in the Pacific. I can't even name 10.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, I think the one we went to is 29 official, something like that. And every country sends a delegation. Aotearoa New Zealand's usually like the superstar of the festival, but they take over a delegation. And so I was on the delegation in 2016, went over, and the project I was on then was like, I was literally running around the island with a handheld recorder, just recording anything and then making beats exclusively out of those samples. So like I might have got the twigs breaking and cool, there's a hi-hat, you know, somebody might have dropped a coconut and it made a hollow ping, and okay, cool, that's our B flat chord. And I was just like really challenging myself to make soundscapes exclusively out of found sound and sampling in them in a way that kind of created a modern aesthetic, hip hop aesthetic. And so that was, you know, I'm quite well known in more bougie art scenes locally for that type of thing. But in terms of travel with, you know, just for music, it's been, oh man, I've been able to see the country, a lot of the Pacifica Oceania region, being over to the States for projects. It's just the blessing, because we love music anyway. The fact that it can allow us to travel and see a bit of the world, that's a huge bonus. And as you say, like being in these different spaces gives you a different inspiration outside of the, you know, the hood or where you're usually based. And I think that's my favorite part about travel, is not only being exposed to new sounds, but new experiences, new ways of living, new ways of thinking. So when we get back to our home base, you know, we're refreshed and got new ideas and new samples and so forth. But I love traveling, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Was there any other countries, so like the States, and then are there any other you're keen to go to that you haven't been to yet?
States, I want to do it properly, because we only went to Hawaii and Seattle, which were beautiful anyway. But I'd love to go to the Mecca. Like, never been to LA or New York. I grew up in Māere, which was very West Coast heavy back in the day. We weren't even listening to Biggie or any New York stuff back in the day, because we were like Team Park, Team Death Row. It wasn't until later on, we, you know, we got exposed to New York and we were like, oh, actually, East Coast hip hop is dope. Super dope. But I mean, I'd love to kind of go check out LA. I guess growing up in South Auckland, there's this relationship in terms of the OGs between Ōtara and Māngere. And having, you know, lived most of my career in both Māngere and Ōtara, like, Māngere is kind of like the Long Beach. We got the slower tempos, we're more laxed out, we're more chill. And Ōtara's the Compton. Ōtara's got the energy waiting to pop off, and the aggression and so forth. And that's always a symbiotic relationship in terms of over there between Compton and Long Beach. And that's the same parallel relationship I found between Ōtara and Māngere, which is kind of like foundational to my career. Shout out FDKNS. But yeah, it's I'd love to go over to the States properly to kind of really just soak in all these places that I idolized growing up. And Europe is another area that I've never been to that I'd really love to kind of check out. I've heard so many great stories about it.
I'm super keen to try New York, especially because, like, I still know to this day a lot of, like, film and TV productions done in New York, not just, like, what people think Hollywood, but a lot of it's still done in New York too. And it'll just be cool see, the opportunities there. Like, if I'm not mistaken, they still, like, I know they do, like, sort of, like, reality shows or, like, property shows and all that, but there's bound to be more little gems somewhere. And I've actually got a, like, a lot of music people that you just come across online, you get to know, and, like, a lot of them in America, it's just so exciting because, like, they're all like, man, you know, you help them literally sometimes and in many ways, not just financially, but could just be like, hey, here's a $2 is all I got, but it can be enough to be like, hey, you know, if I ever come to your side, cool. And then if you ever come to my side, I think that's so exciting. And like, that's just the States, eh? Like, the amount of cool places. But I've always thought England would, like, UK, that would be another cool place too, eh? Like, a lot of electronic, and some of the best ears I've noticed for the electronic. Those guys have some, like, next level engineering. It's kind of like BBC isn't just like the TV and film, it's like a culture, eh? Like, I'm hearing that quality come through. So yeah, I think those would be the big spots. But like, with my dad, his heritage and my background, being Algerian, man, I just can't wait to, like, check out Algeria properly and, like, just find all the little electronic DJs out there and producers and get things rolling there. And that's just, like, so much potential of all the music they've already got, like their traditional Algerian instruments. In fact, I actually remember seeing DJ Snake. He actually had a recent trip to, like, Algeria, and it was just so interesting seeing how they respond to electronic music. There's still so much, like, room for it to expand, you know what I mean? Like, just dance music as opposed to traditional
And you were saying their traditional instruments. What are their traditional instruments? Algerian
instruments? Yeah, so I know they've definitely got the oud, which is like that string one. But yeah, like it's kind of like a fretless stringed instrument. Oh, I'm just got it up on Google. Usually 11 strings grouped in 6 courses. And then there's like harps that are quite similar. They've got a really like really off grid. It's like no time signature to the drums at all. Still definitely a groove you could sample in. So like, and obviously like the biggest ones, they're like little vocals where we like, I don't know, you know, like they've got that really unique tone to so much of their music. So it's just like, man, and to think as well that you know, like even though in like traditional Islamic culture I was sort of pushed away from music, or like a lot of it was like, oh, don't, it's not always good scene around it, like being able to like be around dad and growing up and just be on that journey with him as we've found like, you know, the good side of music, it's just so exciting now to like dive deeper there. So the culture, the whole traveling, that's just for me the ultimate, like it's almost like right up there on the music thing. It's like, yes, yeah, it's a added bonus, but man, I feel like as a musician you could just really eat your heart out through traveling as well. So I think that's the goal, eh? Definitely it's the goal, travel. And especially while, you know, some people I think will have an opportunity, like whether they might be listening in, like they're young, single, whatever, just like, well, you're young, it's probably the best time. And like after lockdown, I think it's just like, man, don't forget, they've got a whole world out there, over 200 countries, you know, like it's crazy. Beautiful
point. And I would reiterate that to anybody out there listening to, especially younger ones, you know, if you get the opportunity to travel while you're young, see the world, get all those different experiences. And you know, you're just adding more colors to your palette, you're adding more strands to your bow, you know, more samples to your packs, you know, young, and that stuff compounds as you get older. But yeah, you're so right. And to talk away, just said about the cultural aspect too, I think that would round out my top three. So I've kind of put out the States properly, the coasts as one, Europe as two, and I think to round out my three would be cultural, back to the islands, Samoa. Want to spend a lot more time back in Samoa now that the borders are open, for that very reason that you just kind of mentioned, you know, the traditional instruments. That's been quite a signature of my work in more recent times, kind of doing a lot more kind of cultural based hip-hop, that kind of shine a light on the indigenous aspects of the instrumentation or the philosophies or the cultural aspects. And so definitely want to spend a bit more time back in the islands as well to kind of really anchor a lot of the kind of cultural identity stuff that I'm wanting to explore these days.
Wow, so awesome. And like on the topic of people and places, kind of like, would there be any sort of specific highlights for me? I definitely know that I've come to learn, just like the few that I had known about have been coming along to the workshops and hearing your story. There was so many more, but for people who haven't sort of known too much about your work or what you've been able to accomplish, off the top of your head, what have been some of the most memorable or standout sort of milestones, whether it be people you've met, places you've been to, or just achievements, my bro?
Oh gosh, that's always an interesting one. Gosh, in my age, you almost forget more than you remember. But some of the standouts, definitely. I mean, there was a performance in 2012 at the Auckland Town Hall as part of the Auckland Philharmonia. They used to have a program called Remix the Orchestra, and I was the musical director for that. And that was actually an award-winning program. It won a musical award in 2013, which is a musical rights award, which is given out by the UN, UNESCO, and they basically gave it a prize saying it was one of the top three music programs in the world. And that was based out at Otanami Zikara Centre. We basically took a whole bunch of hood kids and put them in the studio with classical players and just collabed and wrote songs together and created tracks. But in 2012, we had a highlight performance at Auckland Town Hall, and we had Ehrman, Frisco, a whole bunch of industry artists on it. As the music director, that was a highlight for me because, like, I remember being on stage and they're playing nothing but a G thing. Because I said, you know, I was like in the position to have the orchestra. Like, I actually had a battle and I consulted with some hip hop OGs, DLT, Erman, Olemayava. I was like, I want to do this battle thing with the orchestra. I want the orchestra to put up their top three songs ever in history. And I want them to play that live. And then I want the DJ to play like the top three hip hop songs to respond. So when they play Beethoven's Ninth, what does hip hop play back? And you know, this became like a really big debate, and we settled on three tracks. But I remember standing on stage, full Auckland Town Hall, and looking out into the audience, and you've got some, you know, middle upper class people from Remuera on a, you know, couples night out, lavishly spending $500, sitting next to some hood kids who had snuck their Cody's cans in their bag, but they're all enjoying the same collaboration. You know, and it was music, you know, reaching across social divides. And I that was a crazy moment. Another highlight was in 2011, I think it was 2011, that's when OMC, Paulie Fuemana had passed away the previous year, and so they were looking to do a tribute performance to him at the Silver Scroll Awards. And I was the music director that got to put together the cover version for that, and you know, got Erman doing the rap, got Aradna singing the vocals, had Super Groove doing the brass section, had a traditional Samoan choir, had it was so many elements. And that was crazy having that honor to kind of arrange, you know, his tribute performance for, you know, what is a classic song, How Bizarre. In more recent years, some of the highlights was, you know, doing some of the sound design for Jacinda Ardern, the Dawn Raid public apology. So that was a very historic moment, and I put in a lot of crazy samples into that piece, and a lot of hidden hidden tones and frequencies for that moment. That was pretty big. When she had the Ifonga where they put the fine mat over her at the Auckland Town Hall, that was quite a big one. There's a music and arts center in, so there's three in here in Tamaki Makaurau in Auckland, there's three official music and arts centers. So there's the Otana Music and Arts Center, which is where I learned my craft, and then the Mangere Arts Center, which was built after that, which is where I applied my craft after I left OMAC. And then there's the third one, which is the Glen Innes Music and Arts Center, and that's Te Oro. And so they've got these speakers that are built into the outside roof that plays soundscapes 24/7. And so I was commissioned to create all of those back in 2013 as well. And that was actually officially the first time in New Zealand history they've had a public non-physical work, artwork. Public art is usually physical. It's usually a carving. That's right. Or it's usually like a mural. When they commissioned these music pieces, soundscapes that I spent a year in Glen Innes kind of sampling and recording, that was quite historic as well. So, I mean, there's so many, and I'm like, when I look back at it, like, you don't really think about them in the moment, but when you get asked, when you get put on these, on the spot in these questions, it's like, oh, and then there's the obvious one that's happened recently, which was having a placement on Hobbs and Shaw. For Dwayne the Rock Johnson, and we had a track with Mosul, the movement, a track with Master, and so we got a double sync for that. So we initially got to be in the film. So in the chop shop where they're cutting up the cards, it's playing on the radio in the background. So we got a sync for that, and then not long after we had signed the deal for that, then they came back and they were like, actually, we want the track on the actual official album. Soundtrack compilation, which is another deal. And that was a big learning curve too. And so and to bring things full circle, I remember looking at on the official playlist, because I grew up on Cypress Hill. Before I was Anonymous, I was Cypress. And I remember looking at the soundtrack, and there's Cypress Hill, and there's Anonymous with the movement. And I was like, yo, this is crazy. So there's so lots of highlights, but one thing I've definitely found is every time you get to a finish line, like, it's just another start line. It's like it's not as
yeah
it's not as high as you think. You achieve these things and it's cool for a little bit, like and then it's like really kind of not necessarily depressing, but it's kind of it's like, oh man, I gotta do this all over again for the next thing and so forth. So there's been lots of highlights along the way, but I'm just grateful that I get to just do this for a living, you know, and I'm just blessed.
That's it, eh? And you're carving more and more of that journey, so that it's like, far beyond your life is the legacy of your family, you know, the kids and everything between that. Like, for people who are listening, a lot of inspiration is like the idea that, you know, you can live locally and work globally. And then this time, you know, we have awesome internet here in New Zealand for the most part, and if we don't, there's ways to get hold of it. You know, there's so many things that you know, we're on the forefront of now. You know, we're, you know, like not before, like too long ago, it would be so hard to send all these streams across, and now you just see like a gigabyte uploaded in a minute and you're thinking, man, this is actually where lies the massive opportunity for us all as Kiwis, you know, all of us here in New Zealand, to be able to tautoko, encourage each other to you know, chase the dreams. And yes, it's gonna be hard. You might have to still do a bit of working your job, but you know, there are, like I like to share, there's just golden windows of time, golden windows of opportunity. You might only get 5-10 minutes, but man, you know, that can all add up. And it's just motivation, inspiration, and just testimony as well, eh? Like that someone can share their own experience of what's possible, what you know, the blessings that come from you just, you'll fall in love with the process, and then there's all these bonuses and extras, and they just make it so memorable, you know. Like, this is why I got into music, because I love what music brings, and I also love how music can bring so much more, you know.
Well, it's cool what you're saying. It definitely consolidates it for me. The successes I've had have come about just by being me. Like, you know, like what we were talking about before, like when I was, you know, younger, I was like, oh man, I can't be the classical dude because I might appear like soft to the hip-hop guys, or the hip-hop guys, I can't be cultural because that's fobby, all these things. And yet, you know, having a track like Master on the Rocks, on Fast and the Furious, like they were literally scouring YouTube for Samoan hip-hop. So because I'd been focusing on combining cultural elements into my hip-hop, I got the placement, and that was just me being me. You know, me being, you know, being in that 2012 Auckland Town Hall performance, you know, playing nothing but a whole orchestra playing nothing but a G thing. That was me, not necessarily, that was me leaning into the classical side of me and the hip hop side of me. And so I really encourage everybody out there, whatever your backgrounds are, you know, that make you unique, the circle of friends you hang out with, that you listen to, and maybe it's your culture that you're surrounded by, whatever those different things are that surround you, like those are what make you unique. Build yourself on that. And that's literally been my template for success, was just being unapologetically me. It might not be the coolest thing for me to be sampling twigs and and, you know, waves, but that's gotten me into art galleries around the world, traveling, you know. And so just find your own way. It's what you just do it your way. Find your own way.
Man, and I think if everyone does it their way in a funny, strange way, it can actually bring a lot of win-win in New Zealand, like, because I look at it like, not only is it like there's actually jobs like we all take over from each other that we'd rather do, and like if we would actually all try to do what we wanted to do, I actually feel like every job would, like, or every part of doing the jobs you have to do and then doing the jobs you really get to do and love to do, being able to find that balance, there's certainly room to bring more of a equilibrium and more of an alignment in society. And I see it so much with the kids, like, and I also see it myself now, where it's like, being a lot more prouder of my background being Algerian Kiwi, and having those definitely those experiences that kind of could have easily led me down the path of forgetting who I was in many ways. And now it's like, you know, not only is that such a unique and beautiful thing, but it's you know, it's liberating, it's healing, it keeps you the best you for everyone out there. It's kind of like there's so many win-wins from that. I can start to see a lot of clarity, but I know there'll be a lot of people listening in as well who can really maybe relate or know someone or anything like that. I think that's another big one is, you know, there is plenty of room in this universe for you to be you. So that is so cool, my bro.
100, yeah. Brother. Yo.
Oh, man. Oh, well, I honestly, it's such a great way to cover off, like, your journey. And I know there's so much more that, like, you know, people be able to look up to if they're interested to learn more. And all these great podcasts, you know, here in New Zealand, we're all great friends, you know, because it's just sharing. It's the space, the bar, like, storytelling and passing it on, leaving it here for the next generation. And knowing that, you know, we don't have to feel worried to share the stuff because it's it can help someone, and it's so cool, bro. But now, I guess, like, on that note, like, yeah, would there be any final words? This is kind of also a chance of your plugs, but also just the floor is yours. So I always just share with everyone if you got any things that you know, big things that helped you, or like words of advice, or maybe it's just things that you want to share. This is just like an open space, yeah, for whatever, really. And if not anything, maybe just a little thing for someone who might be getting into music, like just words from you, my bro. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Oh, thank you. In terms of final thoughts, I've got a few. One of them, like right off the bat, I just wanted to express gratitude to you, brother. Like you've always just been this really great shining light of positivity and connection, and you know, just empathy for the game and those on the come up, and using, you know, whatever resources and skills you have to kind of be the plug, be the connect and shine your light. And I just really appreciate your vibes, man. Like, for on the real, man, like you're a good brother, you're a good also. We all appreciate all the different, you know, hustles you do for the game and stuff. Yes. It's you know, it's quite therapeutic talking to somebody from the tribe. So yeah, appreciate that. You know, just underlining what we've already talked about today, you know, it's I really encourage everybody out there to just do you. Like, the game was always about finding your own lane in it, you know, because the rest of society had, you know, walked around with their pants normal, like we rolled up one side, or everybody had the cap forward to shield the sun, we would turn the cap around backwards. Like, it was always about uniquifying it, if that's a word, but like,
yes,
finding your own angle, your own spin on it. You know, everybody's got normal cars, okay, let's put chrome wheels on our car, let's make it lean to the side, let's make it jump, let's make it do something that others don't. So hip-hop as an energy has always been about customize yourself, find your own lane. It's not what we get force-fed a lot by, you know, the mainstream to a certain degree, where they want us to fit into boxes or into lanes or into presets. But, you know, start off with your preset. It's always good to emulate those that you aspire to be like and that inspire you, but find your own lane to add to it. Like, what are you adding to the game that, you know, there's, you know. So that's a big one. Another one piece of advice that I first got given that still stuck with me is, you know, it's not about the gear, it's the ear. So I got taught that earlier on, you know, they were like, don't get caught up in the whole gear thing. Like, develop your ear first. So, like, it doesn't matter what the gear is in front of you, your ear will be able to pull you through that opportunity onto the next thing. And so having stuck to that over the year, I've got all the gear. I mean, I'm blessed in the studio that I'm in right now. I've got all the gear I could want, but the gear only came because I focused on the ear. So, you know, it's not about the gear, it's about the ear. Focus on the ear and it'll get you the gear. That's another one. And lastly, you know, when we are creating music, whether we're sampling it, whether we're inspiring it, you really are participating in a very magical situation. It's time travel. Like, for example, an example I often give out is like Dr. Dre to my knowledge, hasn't collaborated with Beethoven. They lived in different eras. They haven't collaborated with Bob Marley. So here's three legends, just as an example. Dr. Dre, Bob Marley, Beethoven. The world would never be able to hear what the collaboration would have been like because they lived in different intersections of time and space. However, as somebody who grew up on Bob Marley, grew up on Dr. Dre, grew up on Beethoven, through me as a creative, through me as a producer, I am able to allow that impossible, physically impossible thing to be manifested into the quantum field through what I create when I hit record. And so to all you creatives out there and producers and composers, all those inspirations that you're thinking of, all the different elements, you are really wielding magic. You're allowing the impossible to take place by allowing these collaborations and fusions that otherwise would not be able to physically happen. And so, you know, every time I step into the studio, I'm reminding myself that we are in the domain of magic, that we, you know, remind myself to not overthink things, that we can make the impossible possible, and to just lean into our authenticity and just hit record and not overthink things and just express what needs to be expressed. And it is what it is, and it'll be what it becomes.
Oh, man. Well, man, that's so beautiful. And that's pretty much, I think that's pretty much it. And I just wanted to say again, thank you so much for your time. And I think it's been awesome, my bro. But for everyone tuning in, that was Beat Fano podcast with Anonymous. Thank you so much to each and every one of you for all the support helping us get this far. And we're just super blessed to still be going strong. And we're going to keep this thing going. And keep an eye out at this post that we have in coming up with any podcast opportunities for you to be part of this podcast. We're really excited for that. Also, feel free to share this podcast with a friend if you enjoyed it, and spread the word. And we're really looking forward to carry this thing on. A few more podcasts, and then we'll be carrying on for 2023. But I think that's a wrap for now. Blessings, peace, love, and blessings to everyone. That's a wrap here at Beat Fano. Peace and love, y'all.
Salute.
Yeah, that's us, my man.
Sure, brother. That was fun.
Woo! Yeah, so amazing. Oh, bro.